You couldn't be more than 5.
You're so fat, they have to jack you up to take off your shoes.
Yeah, well, you're so skinny, your eyes are in single file.
Well, you're so ugly, your ears stick out to get away from your face.
Well, your mama is
so... Hold it, wait a minute. Don't bring anyone mother into this. She ain't here. If it wasn't for your mother, you wouldn't be here. So remember, when you put down one mother, you put down mothers all over the world.
Episode 327 of the Sala Monster Sounds Off here, special Mother's Day edition, Sunday, May 11, 2014. I am the Sala Monster. Happy Mother's Day to all the moms out there listening to the podcast. Judy Bagwell, Mama Benjamin, Christy, Sam Shaw's mom, all the moms out there. You can listen to this podcast every week on thesalamonster.com, Stitcher Radio, iTunes, Player.fm. There's an Android app, Windows 8 app. Tons of different ways to listen to the show. Also, sign up for an Audible trial. Audibletrial.com/Sala Monster. You can get free 30 days of Audible service plus one free audio book. And you help out the podcast when you sign up at that link. So please, audibletrial.com/Sala Monster. It's a great service. Give it a try and sign up at that link to get your free book. PayPal shout-outs this week. You can always donate via PayPal on thesalamonster.com anytime you want to. Shoutouts this week for Trevon Cannonball Clark, Raging Raul Altamirano, Craig Bone Crusher Chalk, the comic genius Hunter Palmer, who is in fact a comedian in real life. He is the comic genius. Gabriel Dirty Sanchez and Luis, out of time, your ass is mine, Carrillo. Those are your PayPal shoutouts this week. $10 donation or more will get you a nickname, but again, you can donate anything you want to, anytime you want, on thesalamonster.com. You guys help keep this show going, so for those of you who have donated before and will again, I appreciate it. Extreme Rules was last Sunday on pay-per-view on the WWE Network from the Izod Center in East Rutherford, New Jersey. This was the first pay-per-view of the network era that I watched on the network since I was at WrestleMania last month. Went over to a buddy's house. He has the Apple TV set up, so we were all ready to go. And I have to say, it seems like I was in the minority, but we had an awful time trying to stream this show. And he's got the whole setup there. You know, he's got the big TV and everything else. And he watched WrestleMania last month and on the network and had no issues. And so here we are watching Extreme Rules. And from the moment the pre-show started, right through to the end of the pay-per-view, nothing but problems. It would freeze, it would cut out. We switched over, he has a PS3. We were watching it on PS3. PS3 was even worse. And, you know, so more or less the entire time we were watching on like a 240p display. Every now and then it would clear up enough where we had like 480p, but that's about as high as it went. And constantly it did that thing where every 20 or 30 seconds or so, maybe less, it would rewind by 10 seconds or 5 seconds, so we would get a replay of what we just saw. And that's fine if it happens every now and then. It happens on the Roku here. But this was happening every 20 seconds. It got to the point where it was very annoying. So hopefully you guys had a much better time streaming that show than I did, than we did. If I go over to his place again, we're probably going to try it again next month for payback. And this time what he's going to try to do is hardwire you know, the modem to things. We'll try to hardwire it and see if maybe that improves it. We shouldn't have to do that, but if that's the only way, then so be it. But yeah, had a bitch of a time trying to stream this show. Overall, it was a good show. I think the key matches, I mean, the biggest match of all on this show was the Shield Evolution six-man tag team match. And that match was awesome. It was awesome. And everything that match should have been, it was everything that I expected that match to be and more. I mean, these guys went all out. Credit to everybody involved, including Triple H and Orton and Batista. They put the Shield over like $1 million. Seth Rollins is a crazy man. He's going to die one of these days. Hopefully not anytime soon. Roman Reigns gets the big pin in the end on Dave Batista. And the Shield come out of it looking as strong as they ever have. And it's going to be a great day when the Shield, ultimately, they come out with a Shield Best Of DVD set. I mean, you could probably put a list together, and they've only been around for about a year and a half, but if you put a list together right now of the best Shield matches to put on, let's say, a two-disc DVD, maybe three, I don't even know where to begin. They've had so many matches, even on SmackDown, and just matches that you probably wouldn't even think of, but they're so damn good. And this match would be probably at the head of the pack, the matches with the Wyatt family, especially the match they had at Elimination Chamber, the match on Raw in Chicago when they had their rematch. They had another match on TV this week. Wasn't as good as those first two, but it was still pretty good. So the Shield kicking all kinds of asses, baby faces, and it's good. It's good to see that they kept these guys together. They didn't break them up prematurely. I say keep them together for as long as you can run with this. And who's to say you even have to break up the Shield and they have to turn on each other? They could go their separate ways at some point, but still be, you know, they could still be buddies. You know, they could still be friends. They could team back up every now and then. I'm just saying, you don't have to have one guy turn on the other when that time comes. So that was awesome. That sold the whole show for me. Daniel Bryan and Kane in the main event. They did get the main event spot, WWE Championship match. I liked the match. It harkened back to one of those pay-per-view main events you would see back during the Attitude Era, let's say when Steve Austin was the champion, and he would go against somebody like Kane, or he would go against Mankind. And it wasn't really a wrestling match. It wasn't supposed to be a wrestling match. You know, Daniel Bryan was not going to go in there and have a Matt Classic with Kane. And we've seen that match so many times before. Bryan has beaten Kane clean. It's like, what could they possibly do differently in this match to make it different than all the other matches we've seen them have before? And to their credit, they did that. They tried. They went backstage. There was a car there. Of course, as soon as you saw the car, my friend's a big car buff. I mean, he does insurance claims for a living. So the first thing he said when he saw the car, I forgot what kind of car it was, but it was like an older car. He goes, all right, there's only one reason why there would be an older car sitting there. And sure enough, they beat the crap out of the car. It's like when Vince McMahon drove his prize Corvette to that one Raw episode back in 98. That was the show. It was at the Nassau Coliseum. I was actually there. And it was the angle where Steve Austin filled McMahon's Corvette up with cement, or as Jim Ross said, semen. Sounded like he said the Corvette got filled with semen, which would be kind of nasty. But he filled it up with cement, and, you know, it's like an old Corvette, and the idea that Vince McMahon would drive this old Corvette, you know, like he's a classic car buff or something. It's like, you know, I don't know what year it was from, but it was clearly an older car. It was not a new vehicle. It's like whenever you see an older car at one of these shows, you know bad things are going to happen. There's a reason why I don't think any of the cars Alberto Del Rio drove in when he used to drive those cars in for his entrance, and they would say, oh, this car is worth $400,000 or $250,000. You'll notice, rarely if ever, were any of those cars even touched. You know, there's a reason for that. So they brawled all over the place. They went back to the ring eventually. They, to my surprise, did a spot in the end with fire. You don't see too many of that kind of stuff here during the PG era in WWE. But they did. They set the table on fire. Kane fell through I mean, it was as safe can be. You know, fire is unpredictable, so it's never really safe. But they did the best they could. Clearly, parts of the table, there was like flame retardant on the table, because the whole table didn't just go up in flames, only like the ends did. But Kane went through the table. They had the guys there with the fire extinguishers to put him out right away. And Kane comes back into the ring, gets the knee, the dragon knee to the face. 1-2-3, Bryan wins. I was not a fan of Kane popping up and no-selling fire at the end of the pay-per-view. And the pay-per-view goes off the air with Kane's music playing. That seemed kind of goofy to me. We've since found out, it seems, that The idea had been for Bryan to meet Batista at the next pay-per-view for the championship. Batista basically said, fuck off, I'm not doing that. He has his reasons. I don't think it has anything to do with Bryan. I've always had the impression that, you know, Batista's a Daniel Bryan fan. You know, he put Bryan over pretty strong right before he left the company. And then they had that one match on Raw. It was a beat-the-clock match 4 years ago. By all intents, back then, you know, Batista was challenging for the title. He was in the main event. Bryan was a new guy, this scrawny-looking new guy. He probably should have squashed him, but he didn't. He had a competitive match with him. He made him look good. So I don't think there's any issue between Batista and Bryan. I just think, you know, Batista's run has probably not gone the way he had envisioned when he came back, I think it's safe to say. He went to WrestleMania. He took the losing fall in the main event of WrestleMania. He not only took the losing fall to Bryan, he tapped out. So I doubt very seriously that he's got an issue with Daniel Bryan. I mean, it's probably just a case where he said, look, you know, I did the job at WrestleMania. I tapped out to this guy. I did the job at Extreme Rules, okay? Let your next big golden boy, Roman Reigns, pin me clean as a sheet in the middle of the ring. I'm not going to another pay-per-view and losing on my way out when I have to go promote my movie. So that's kind of where we are now. They talked Batista into staying through the next pay-per-view. It looks like we'll get another Evolution Shield match. And then after that, Batista's going to be gone for a while. He's going off to promote his Guardians of the Galaxy movie. I'm sure he'll be back. It may be many months. It may be a few months. Who knows? But I'm sure he's not too thrilled with things right now. But anyway, that put them in a bind, because now all of a sudden their main event for Payback is off the table. So what do you do? So they made a decision. We're going to continue the feud with Bryan and Kane, a feud that should have had one match and that's it. This was going to be a one-off, and you move the guy on to somebody else, because Kane is hardly the best opponent. You know, Kane should not be challenging for the championship at this point. Daniel Bryan needs better opponents than Kane to get himself over as the champion. So they were put in this bind. They're doing the match again. I'm reading it. It may be a Buried Alive match. I actually don't have a problem with that. I like Buried Alive matches. I know I probably shouldn't. They're kind of like a guilty pleasure of mine. They're not always good. But I kind of like the Buried Alive stip. It's something different. It's certainly something that you wouldn't expect a guy like Daniel Bryan to be in. He's out of his element there. If they do it, though, you know, that's fine. They have to do one more gimmick match and then move on. It's just the card that was dealt to them. I just, you know, the idea that they don't have anybody else. Like, Batista bails on them, so the only thing they could do in their mind is have another Daniel Bryan Kane match. In their head, there's nobody else that they can put into that spot. There's no other heel on the roster. You know, had they turned Sheamus heel already, like they probably should have, you could be, you know, setting up a Bryan-Sheamus feud for the next one or two pay-per-views. You know, if they actually went and put Bray Wyatt in there with Daniel Bryan, which would make sense given that he finally beat Cena, he beat Bryan many months ago, we could be doing Bryan and Bray at the next pay-per-view. Instead, it's going to be Rematch-a-Mania. That's what Payback is going to be. This always happens when WrestleMania season ends for like 2 or 3 months. It's rematch after rematch after rematch. And now you look at the card, the top of the card for Payback at this point. Nothing's been officially announced. But it sure looks like the top three matches are going to be exactly the same. Maybe the stips will be different, but the matches, it's going to be Bryan and Kane, Cena and Wyatt, probably in the rubber match of their feud, and Shield and Evolution, the same three main events. So it's rematch-a-mania. But, you know, it is what it is. I'm going to get more into the Bryan Kane stuff in a second. Let me just get back to the pay-per-view here. We have John Cena and Bray Wyatt. I just want to comment on this. This match sucked, okay? This match was awful. It was terrible. Their WrestleMania match look like fucking, you know, Michaels and Bret in an Iron Man match at WrestleMania, okay? It was terrible. And the people saying, well, this did nothing for Bray Wyatt. It buried Bray Wyatt. It didn't bury Bray Wyatt, okay? Bray Wyatt won the match. People are not going to remember 2 months from now that it took all this interference from Harper and Rowan, and that's the only reason Cena won. That's how Cena's booked. He's Superman. That's it. It's the same thing with Bray Wyatt. It's the same thing with every other person he's been in the ring with except Daniel Bryan. They had one match and Bryan won. Everybody else, it's the same song and dance with Cena. It's no different with Bray Wyatt. He got the win. That's the most important thing. He came out a winner. He came out on Raw the next night. He did this whole promo about how now I'm a somebody. I beat John Cena. I'm a somebody now. And the people were still behind him. So the people who like Bray Wyatt and they're cheering and they're swaying back and forth and they're singing, he's got the whole world in his hands. it's not going to stop all of a sudden because he had a bad performance and he was made to look weak at the pay-per-view. He's a heel. He needs other people to fight his battles for him. I just thought the match itself sucked. And the finish, you know, it's just, you know, it was unique. I will say that, it was unique, but the finish also sucked. John Cena is looking at this kid on the outside and he's scared. All of a sudden he's scared. Scared of what? I don't know. Maybe he's scared of the poor job they did digitizing his voice over the loudspeaker. He couldn't believe how awful it was. I don't know. He was so terrified that he backtracked into the cage right into his sister Abigail, and Bray Wyatt left. The kid they used for the angle apparently was Jameson's son, which is kind of random. Jameson was a comedy character back in the early 90s. This nerdy, geeky character. He had like the pocket protector and the big, thick eyeglass frames, and he had this snot rag he carried around with him. Bobby Heenan would constantly make fun of him. Actually, he was a fixture on the Bobby Heenan show. Bobby Heenan had a show on USA Network, like a talk show. Very short run. Only had about four episodes, but Jameson was kind of his co-star on that show. So, yeah, apparently it was Jameson's kid. The fact that Jameson had a kid is frightening to me. Gives all of us hope, I suppose. But, yeah, this match sucked. It was actually one of the worst pay-per-view matches of the year so far. Not a good performance for either one of these guys. It's a match that they need to put behind them as quickly as possible. And if they're going to do another match of Payback, which I'm sure they will, I don't know what gimmick they're going to come up with here, but keep it simple. Just go out there and just have a good focus on having a good match and erasing the memory of this one, because this was awful. And what made it even worse was I was on my show last week and I was ranting and raving about the cage, right? And this talk about how the cage is going to keep the Wyatt family out. And it's so important that I beat Bray Wyatt, because if I don't, his message is going to escape the cage, right? His message, I guess his message now is free. His message is a fugitive. It's on the run. It escaped because Bray Wyatt wanted the pay-per-view. But, you know, as I predicted, this whole notion of the cage keeping people out was complete bullshit. From the very beginning of the match, there's Harper, there's Rowan, they're on the outside circling the cage like sharks. Then they start climbing. Harper ended up in the cage at one point. I just wish they would stop trying to peddle all of that phony bullshit to us about how the cage keeps people out. In 2014, the cage does not keep people out. The cage is an accessory. And I don't even know why they bother having cage matches today, because, you know, they don't do blood anymore. Everybody just interferes anyway. What's the fucking point of even having a cage match? I don't really see the point. Pop a rating on TV? All right, maybe. Do they really, though? Do cage matches really make that much of a difference on TV anymore? Probably not. I think they're kind of played out, quite frankly. But we had Paige and Tamina. They were in the buffer match, which, of course, the women would be on this pay-per-view. But they had the WLC match on the pre-show. And the WLC match, I have to say, I enjoyed that. And I said that last week. I said this could turn out, if it's not just bad comedy, and it was a lot, it was made for comedy, but if it wasn't just bad comedy, if they actually had a match, this could turn out to be pretty entertaining. And that's exactly what they did. These little guys went in there, and they had what probably was the third best match on the entire show. The Shield match was number one. Bryan and Kane, I'd put number two. WLC was in the top three on this. I would rather see 10 WLC matches than the John Cena Bray Wyatt cage match on that show. These guys went out there. They worked hard. They did all these, I was going to say high spots. Maybe that's not the right word for it. But they're bringing out ladders. They're bringing out tables. And even the guys, you know, 3MB's out there. The Matadors are out there. Drew McIntyre is a madman. At one point, he did a flip dive over the top rope. Nobody caught him. He just landed right on the mat. On the thin mats on the floor. It was crazy. It just complete insanity. This was one of those matches you would see back in the Attitude Era. All these wacky, crazy spots with tables and ladders and chairs and shit, and guys just beating the crap out of their own bodies. That's what this match was. It was a car crash. But the bigger point I want to make here is that you can build a minis division around these guys. You can build a minis division specifically around El Torito, because El Torito, when he's in there and he's doing his thing, is awesome. But at some point, it gets a little old with Torito and Hornswoggle. You need more people. You need more minis. The women died a death on this show. I felt bad for Tamina, I felt bad for Paige. It's Paige's first title defense on pay-per-view, and it wasn't a very good match. And it wasn't, you know what, I take that back. It wasn't even that the match was bad, it was that the crowd was dead. The crowd was dead because they just came off that Shield Evolution match from earlier, which was awesome, and they came off whatever the fuck that thing was between Cena and Wyatt, which was terrible. It killed the crowd. So these women go out there before the main event, and they never stood a chance. And I'm tired of seeing it. I'm tired of seeing it, and something has to change. Well, if you want a buffer match, if you had a minis division, why not let the little guys be the buffer and actually give the women some breathing room? Let the women open the show. Put the women in the second match on the show. Don't put them in a position to fail. You know, the minis are going to go out there, and people are going to laugh, and they're going to be entertained. And it's good comic relief. It's good relief between, let's say, the two main events. The women do not deserve to be in that position on every single show. They died a death at WrestleMania because people couldn't believe the streak ended. Nobody cared. I mean, that whole women's battle royal, I was in the building. It's like a blur. I barely remember anything that happened. So I say, build a minis division, which can be very entertaining, and make them the buffer on these pay-per-view shows from now on, and move the women up the card a little bit. Give them a few extra minutes. And move them up the card so whether they're out there for 5 minutes or 10 minutes, at least they have a shot at getting the crowd into their match, and the crowd isn't just sitting there on their hands. As long as they insist on putting them on right before the main event every single month, it's going to be the same thing over and over again. And Paige is going to go out there, and she's going to defend her title, and nobody's going to give a shit. And maybe that starts to fuck with her head. Maybe that tells people backstage, hey, this is not working. People don't care about her as champion, or people don't care about the women. They don't care because you put them in a position to fail. You've got these minis. You can build it up. Put them in the buffer match. That's what I would do. Let's move on to Raw. Monday night. Show was live from Albany, New York. Another overall bad crowd. I don't know what the hell's going on lately. These crowds have just been horrendous. But Mick Foley. I want to start with Mick Foley here because he posted a blog. Mick Foley's been very vocal lately. He's been very vocal against WWE. I didn't sign a new deal with them because my video game royalties were not what they should be. And, you know, he's been ragging on the Bryan stuff for a while, you know, back after the Royal Rumble. Him and his whole family exploded on social media bashing WWE. And anyway, Foley posted something on his Facebook page that said, be careful, be very careful. It was a warning to Daniel Bryan. I want to read some of this to you. He said, whether Daniel Bryan knows it or not, now is the time that the fiercest fighting takes place for a WWE champion. And it has nothing to do with the action in the ring. Now is the time to step up and shoot down horrible ideas that can derail even the most promising of careers. I used to joke that Daniel was the exception to the rule that every top guy in WWE has been perceived at one time or another as a pain in the neck, largely for their willingness to step up and call the creative team out on bad ideas when they see them. That thing I saw tonight, that thing with Daniel Bryan and Brie Bella, and the car, that was a bad idea, one that never should have seen the light of day. I have said on several occasions that I used up my ammo when it came to complaining about WWE storylines when I went to bat for the Yes Movement in the aftermath of the Royal Rumble. I'm going to do my very best to do just that, but I'll first ask everybody involved, Daniel, Brie, Hunter, Steph, Vince, etc., to take a good look at the nearly identical storyline that ran Zack Ryder's promising career off the rails and do everything they can to avoid that same horrible stretch of track. So that's from Mick Foley, who clearly was not a fan of that storyline on Monday night. I want to play some audio for you here from one of our listeners. Normally I would do this during the mailbag segment, but since this is relevant to the storyline here, I don't want to get into it again later on. I want to get it all out now. Cole from Philadelphia sent in an audio question that has to do with the Daniel Bryan Kane nonsense. So I want to play some quick audio of his question here, and then we'll get into it.
So 10 years ago at a house show in El Paso, Texas, JBL interrupts an early Mother's Day celebration that then WWE champion Eddie Guerrero was enjoying with his wife, kids, and mother, in which he promptly got his family to safety, but as soon as he turned around, he was nailed with a clothesline by JBL. My point is, Eddie didn't run away, so why is it that the current WWE champion Daniel Bryan ran away like a coward from Kane this past Monday, and on top of all that, he let Stephanie McMahon, his enemy for the past 9 months, protect him and his wife Brie from Kane? The saddest part of all this is that Daniel Bryan's parody Eric Young is being booked better as a world champion than Brian is.
I wanted to play that audio from Cole because I thought he made a very good point there on the Eddie JBL stuff. I almost forgot about that whole angle, but they did that thing. They actually taped that at a house show, and they showed footage on TV. They should do more of that, where they were celebrating Mother's Day. Like he said, Eddie's family was there. JBL came out. Now, granted, JBL is not a demon. Another fucking pet peeve I'll get to in a second, like Kane is. But still, JBL is this evil heel, right? This villain. And he comes out, and I remember he was trash-talking them, and, you know, one thing led to another. It got physical, and Eddie's mom, they did this whole heart attack angle. And, you know, but Eddie got his family to safety first before he turned around and walked into a clothesline from hell. Eddie didn't run away with his family. He said, here, you go here, and I'm going to take care of this. Now, he got his ass kicked, but still. So what makes that different from this? Other than the fact that, again, in storyline, Kane is supposed to be this monster demon character, okay? I could only suspend my disbelief so much. We with Kane, you know what you're getting, okay? You're getting the supernatural stuff and the fire from the posts and all that kind of stuff, okay? I understand that. But I'm pretty much in agreement with everybody else on this angle, which is that this angle sucked. This was terrible television. I got a text message I posted on my Twitter from a friend of mine who is a casual fan at best. Used to be really big time into it, especially during the Monday Night Wars. Not so much now, but he's over the last 6 months or so, he has started getting back into it way more than I thought he would, to the point where we can actually now have conversations that go on for some time just about wrestling, not just about other stuff. And that's kind of cool. And one of the things that have brought him and his wife now, back into the wrestling fold, so to speak, has been Total Divas. She is a big fan of Total Divas. She got him to start watching Total Divas. And so through that show, they've become big fans of John Cena, big fans of Daniel Bryan, and big fans of the Bella Twins. So that was really what got them back involved. And now they watch the shows, and they have their favorites also. Now they're big time into the Usos, and they're big time into some of the other guys. Fandango, again, I think it has everything to do with the show. I take it that Fandango and the Usos are on Total Divas. I don't watch it, so I don't know. But the point is, I got a text message from him after Raw ended last Monday, ranting, two full text messages ranting about how god-awful this angle was. And this is coming from the perspective of a casual fan, not you know, guys like you and me who pick this shit apart every single week. And it's to the point with him now where I get the impression that he may be kind of falling back out of it, because one of the things he liked about WWE was Daniel Bryan, his ascent to the top, winning the championship, and Bryan to him kind of represents what a real wrestler should be like. You know, he goes in there, he has great matches, he kicks ass, you know, he's a small guy, but still. And he watched this and said, this is complete goofy, phony horror movie bullshit. It wasn't believable, it wasn't funny, it wasn't dramatic, it was sad, it was pathetic, and on top of all that, he's the champion. And he's running away, and his girlfriend is a terrible actress, which we already knew. We knew Brie was a terrible actress if you go back to when Bryan was feuding with Randy Orton. And remember that one Raw where Orton was beating the crap out of Bryan at ringside and Brie ran down? And she was terrible. She's awful. She needs acting lessons. Either that or just keep her off TV. She's terrible. Sweet girl, but just terrible actress. But he was just appalled by the whole thing. And I can't say that I blame him. Because you have a guy here who needs all the help in the world, right? He doesn't have any strong opponents right now, to the point where he has to now wrestle Kane twice on back-to-back pay-per-views. He won the first match. He'll win the next match, I'm sure. So he's winning, which is good. He's winning. They're not beating him down like they did Rey Mysterio when Rey Mysterio had the world title and he lost every fucking match he was in. Okay, he lost to Kali. He lost to everybody. Chris Sabin in TNA, another example. Horrible champion. Bryan has not been booked like those guys. Let's not exaggerate. But he comes out on television, and the whole story on this show is him and Brie are backstage, and weird things are happening. Stephanie comes in. She's banging on the door with her man hands. That was the other theme of the show. Every time Stephanie popped up, she was banging on a door. She was banging on a car window. She's like, oh my God, I didn't realize I was striking it so hard. You know, my hands, I just have a heavy hand. She's got man hands, like Seinfeld. Anyway, so Stephanie comes in. Oh, you know, you guys, I'm going to call a car so you guys can get out of here. The Demon Kane, you don't know where he is. You don't know what he's going to do. The Demon Kane this and the Demon Kane that. The fucking guy was dressed like an office manager for the past 6 months. All of a sudden, he's a fucking demon. You know, and it's one thing to call him the Demon Kane once or twice. When you call him the Demon Kane every 5 fucking minutes, every fucking time she mentions his name, it's the Demon Kane. They go back to commentary. Michael Cole, the Demon Kane. JBL, the Demon Kane, Maggle. Jerry Lawler, the Demon Kane. Enough with the Demon Kane bullshit, okay? I get it. He's a demon. He's a bad dude. I don't need you to call him the fucking demon every 5 seconds, please. But, you know, Stephanie has been mortal enemies with this guy for like 8 or 9 months now. But all of a sudden she's so concerned, and she's been doing this shtick for a while, this fake concern that she has for Brian and Brie. But she says, I'm going to call a car for you, and they go, like a bunch of lemmings. They go to the car. Now we have a camera in the car. Car won't start. Brian gets out. Actually, I have to go back here because Stephanie comes banging on the car. Oh, you got a match. So now he has to go wrestle Del Jabo, Alberto Del Jabo, out in the ring. He beats him. But eventually we go back to the parking garage. Now they're in the car. Car won't start. Brian gets out. He checks. I think somebody called it the trunk. I don't know if it was Brian or somebody called it the trunk. I don't know who it was. I guess the trunk is new slang for the hood. So he picks the hood up. He looks. Well, it looks like there's a wire that's missing here, or like a wire that's disconnected. A horrible mechanic Daniel Bryan would be. He puts the hood down. Kane's in the back seat. And that's when the screaming started. Brie Bella starts screaming in terror or something, maybe pain. I don't know. This was horrible. Horrible. I came this close to muting the television, like literally muting the television. I couldn't stand it anymore. She just wouldn't shut up. Like they start, Brian and Kane now start fighting. You would think, okay, she can get out of the car now, go off to the side and kind of keep her mouth shut. Nope. She just kept screaming and screaming and screaming and screaming. I wanted so badly for Stephanie to come out and just slap her across the face and say, shut up. This coming from the woman who can't stop saying Demon Kane. Even she's like, enough. But no, she never did. Brie kept screaming. I mean, I hope she doesn't scream like that when they're together in bed. I mean, not even Viagra would be able to help me if that were the case. That scream, that blood-curdling scream, it's just the most unsexiest thing I've ever heard in my life. It sounds like a freaking animal is suffering. It's got like a spear through its head or something, and you just got to put it down. So the screaming is going on while they're brawling. Brian and Brie get back in the car. They I think Kane's on top of the car, and as they pull away, all of a sudden the car works, by the way. So much for that wire. So they pull away, Kane falls off the car, you hear a splat. They stop the car, camera pans back, there's Kane laying perfectly straight, prone, lifeless body on the ground. Brian gets out. This is just straight out of a horror movie from the 1980s, like one of the old Friday the 13th movies. Or take your pick, any slasher movie from the last 25 years, 30 years. Brian stops the car, gets out to check on Kane. All of a sudden, Kane does his zombie sit-up. Brian runs back to the car and quickly drives off, and we never hear from him again. So yes, the WWE champion, who just disposed of this man the night before, he had no problem beating Kane the night before, beat him with his move, 1, 2, 3, all of a sudden, scared shitless of this guy. His wife is in the car, his wife is safe. He got back in the car, ran away, and drove off. Pathetic. This whole thing made the Ken Anderson, Sam Shaw storyline at TNA look like Breaking Bad by comparison. Brian after that should just be forced to vacate the title. And his man card. That's it. Forfeit the title, have a tournament for it. Don't even put him in the tournament. He doesn't deserve to be in the tournament. I mean, how do you book a world champion to run away like that from his opponent? And I don't want to hear from people he was protecting his wife. He got in the car, he ran away. There's any number of things he could have done with his wife. He couldn't go to John Cena and say, listen, John, Nikki, please, can you just watch over Brie? Watch her. I got to take care of this. Drive back to the hotel. Lock her in the hotel room. Come back to the building with a fucking lug wrench and go after Kane. No, he didn't do that. He ran away like a pussy. So I agree with Mick Foley on this one. The guy should have the balls to stand up and look at this and say, you know what? This is fucking terrible. I'm not doing this shit. Here's a better idea. Let's do this instead. I mean, you go back to the Attitude Era, there was a lot of goofy, over-the-top stuff there. I mean, The Undertaker tried to embalm Steve Austin on a show once. But did Steve Austin run away? Actually, I think he did run away in that segment. But you know what? If The Undertaker was coming after you, trying to cut you open, okay, from chest down to crotch, okay, and gut you like a fish, you'd run away too. That's a bad example. Most champions back then, most champions now, John Cena, Superman, right? When was the last time John Cena ran away from somebody as champion? When was the last time that ever happened, that the babyface champion ran away? Doesn't happen that way. And there's a reason why it doesn't happen that way. There's a reason why it's usually the heel who's the chicken shit heel who's the one running away. Because it's easy heat. Nobody likes somebody who runs away from their opponent. So it's baffling to me that they would book. Maybe it shouldn't be. I mean, there's a lot of people who have, after WrestleMania, said, okay, watch now, they're going to book him. Why are they going to book him as like a loser champion? I don't think they've done that so far. But this did not do him any favors on Monday night. And I hope this is not a sign of what's to come in the next 3 weeks before the next pay-per-view, that they're going to go down the horror movie route like they did with fucking John Cena and Zack Ryder. Zack Ryder being pulled down to hell. They already did that. He tried to pull Bree down to TNA. Okay? It didn't work. But if this is what they have in mind week to week to week, this thing is just going to kill him. It's going to kill him. It's going to kill his whole run. And it's going to drive off at least some of the casual fans, like my friend I mentioned earlier, who are watching this going, who the hell's going to watch this bullshit? And they're just going to quit. People like you and me, it's like an addiction. We're still going to watch this BS no matter what. But you're going to drive off a whole bunch of people if you keep doing stuff like this. Sheamus is the new United States champion, so the famous reign of Dean Ambrose has finally come to an end, I think 355 days or so. What a great champion he was. It was a 20-man battle royal, so the authorities stacked the deck against Ambrose. It came down to Sheamus and Ambrose. He ate a brogue kick. Sheamus threw him out. I thought as battle royals go, it was actually pretty good. The one thing I have to say that just pissed me off was Santino Marella. And this Cobra gimmick, he needs to go away forever. The Cobra, or him, or both, need to leave. Permanently. He busted out the Cobra in the middle of this battle royal. He eliminated Dolph Ziggler with the Cobra. So that tells you everything you need to know about Dolph Ziggler standing in the company. They could, you know, every now and then they'll do something with Dolph. They did a whole skit with him and Hugh Jackman, right? This big A-list Hollywood celebrity. You would think, wow, they chose Dolph Ziggler to be in the segment with Hugh Jackman last week. That's got to mean something, right? But then again, Damian Sandow was in that same segment. We all know what they think of him. So yeah, he used the fucking Cobra to eliminate Dolph Ziggler, which, by the way, pissed everybody in the crowd off. So for some reason, despite the way he's been booked for the last 10 months or so, ever since he came back from his concussion, there are still people who are very much into Dolph Ziggler and who very much want to see him succeed, and the company has other ideas. So the fans were not happy about that. But just the sight now, I get irrationally angry at the sight of that Cobra now. I think it has to do with Emma. Because I feel like he's pulling Emma down into this just comedy abyss with him. And Emma has her own pink Cobra. Now she's losing matches on NXT and stuff. And, oh, God, please, just go away. But the Battle Royal itself was actually pretty good. And I'd say, you know, now that Sheamus is the champion, it's the perfect time to build to a unification match with Bad News Barrett and do a double turn. Do a double turn. Sheamus goes heel, Barrett goes face. You know, Barrett's catchphrase is catching on. People are already cheering the guy. He's been a heel his entire WWE run from the start when the Nexus invaded up until now. I don't think he's been a babyface at any point. You know, let him run with a face. Let him run as a face, rather, with attitude. And just merge those two useless belts into one intercontinental title. I got some feedback to the column I did on PW Mania a couple weeks ago. Got a lot of people who agreed with me, but some were just appalled by the notion that I would want to merge them and get rid of the U.S. title. You can't do that. Some people think we need more titles. We need a TV title. We need a European title, hardcore title, cruiser. Why don't you give a title to everybody? Give a title to everybody on the roster while you're at it. How about that? Why don't we just give everybody a belt? We need less, not more. Okay, I'm with you. I wish that both titles were very strong, and we could add, let's say, one more. A fun thing like I think the hardcore thing kind of passed, that was from a different era, but maybe, you know, if they had a cruiserweight division, I'd have no problem having a cruiserweight belt. I think a TV title is kind of useless. Maybe a cruiserweight belt. You know, I could live with that. But look at who you're dealing with here, people, okay? Look at who's booking these shows. Look at who is booking these titles. Look at the way they're booking these titles. How in your right mind could you argue for more belts at a time when they have not meant as little as they do today? How could you argue that? There is no argument. There is no argument for more titles. Merge the two belts and be done with it. At least that way, the one title that you're left with, you have a chance. Okay, if they actually have an interest in making it mean something, you have a chance in having a secondary belt that means something. As long as there are two, neither one's going to mean a damn thing. So now's the time to do it. And do a double turn while you're at it. They talked about the WWE Network throughout the entire show, and again, I don't think I've mentioned this yet, but their catchphrase now, their slogan, is WWE Network. Just like Netflix, only better. That may be the worst slogan in the history of slogans. I take that back. The slogan that they've been using up until now was WWE Network. It's way over the top. That probably is the worst slogan in the history of slogans. You know, Netflix last year ended the year with 44 million subscribers. I think those people would probably disagree with you that the WWE Network is better than Netflix. 44 million subscribers, it's a pretty high number. Now granted, the WWE Network has only been out for a few months, but they're struggling to reach a million. I'd keep my mouth shut as far as that goes. We had a Bray Wyatt promo, the one I mentioned earlier. He talked about how he's a somebody now after beating John Cena. I said this on Twitter. I like to think that at some point we find out that Nikki Bella is behind all the stuff with the kids as her way of sending a message to John that she wants kids of her own. Be an interesting little plot twist. Alexander Rusev appears to be the latest victim of losing their first name, even though the announcers, they were still calling him Alexander. But it does appear he's now just Rusev. And he is also no longer the Bulgarian Brute. He is now billed as being from Russia. So you see? That's the power of Lana and her legs, my friends. The guy changed his entire home country just to make this woman happy. She's got him wrapped around her finger. Actually, if I had a woman who had legs like Lana, I'd probably change my home country too. You could call me from fucking Poland. I don't care. He also appears to hate black people because he's now destroyed Xavier Woods about, 1,000 times. R-Truth, now Kofi Kingston on this show he squashed. If I'm Big E or Mark Henry, I'd be worried. JTG doesn't wrestle, so he's got nothing to worry about. Racist Rusev. That's an interesting gimmick choice. On Twitter, Big E said he gets the impression that Rusev probably also hates cornbread and hip-hop. I thought that was quite great. They did some Cinco de Mayo comedy with the Matadors, Torito, 3MB, and Hornswoggle. The announcers laughed through the entire thing. This was insufferable. Best thing on the entire show, besides the main event, in all honesty, was a Mother's Day tribute with clips from Mr. T's Hall of Fame speech. I thought it was hilarious, okay? I got a kick out of it. But if I'm a celebrity, I never, ever want to work with WWE ever again after pulling a stunt like this. Hopefully T was okay with it. He was cool with it, because if not, it was just disrespectful for them to do that. It was funny. Again, I enjoyed it. But it was so disrespectful. So I would hope they cleared it with him, or they didn't, but he was cool with it. I don't think he said anything on Twitter about it. Look, his Hall of Fame speech will go down as one of the worst of all time, but he was clearly speaking from the heart. He talked about his mother about 48,000 times. But now they're just mocking the guy. And, like I said, if I'm a celebrity and I see them do stuff like that, I never want to work with a company like that. We had Uncle Zeb Coulter, out there with Jack Swagger. He had a deportation list. People on there like Paige, Sheamus, among others. This was the debut of Adam Rose. Adam Rose's big debut. He comes out with the Exotic Express, comes down to the ring. This was not a good debut for Adam Rose. He didn't wrestle. I get the impression he's not wrestling until the pay-per-view. He's probably going to have a match with Swagger at Payback, so it's probably going to be another 3 weeks of him just coming out or cutting promos and stuff. You know, he comes out, he goes in the ring. Zeb is appalled by what he sees here. And he should be appalled more that Adam Rose is a foreigner. You can hear the accent, and that never really came up. Maybe that's why he hates him. Adam Rose's expression is, don't be a lemon, be a rosebud, which I think is really lame, and I hope he comes up with something better than that, because if that's all he says every week is, don't be a lemon, be a rosebud, that's not going to get over. What killed him in this segment, though, and it was funny, the minute it happened, I said to myself, he's dead. That's it. The guy's dead. Because the crowd wasn't reacting the way they clearly wanted them to. Yeah, you could see, again, some people were bobbing their heads and moving, but by and large, the crowd did not react. They didn't know what to make of this, or they didn't care. Or maybe they were tired because they were seeing a shit show. I don't know what the reason was. But this really did not get over. And so when the segment is over, they go to the announcers at ringside, and we see Michael Cole dancing to Adam Rose's music. If there's one thing that you want to avoid at all costs when you're trying to get a new babyface over or something cool, is Michael Cole dancing to their music. Nothing screams uncool more than having the support of Michael Cole. Hopefully, as the weeks go on, they'll do more stuff with him, and people will get into it. And again, maybe it was just the crowd in Albany, which really didn't react to much the whole night. But this was not a good debut for Adam Rose, I didn't think. Main event was Shield and the Wyatt family. They had a good match, as they always do. Probably the weakest of the three. Actually, I guess it would be four. They had a match on Main Event like a month and a half ago that was actually very good. So of the four matches they've now had on TV, the four six-mans, this was probably the weakest of the bunch, but still a good match. Evolution came at it. It broke down in the end. Big brawl. Even though it broke down, the match, for whatever reason, was not thrown out. I don't think it was no DQ, but in the end, Bray Wyatt hit Sister Abigail on Roman Reigns and got the pin. So maybe it was no DQ. I don't know. Maybe I missed something here. And Evolution left the Shield laying in the end to continue their feud. So it does appear like they are building to a rematch at Payback. Rematch for Mania, brother! Running wild. Although a rematch of the match they had at Extreme Rules, I don't mind. If they could have a match like they had there, I'm sold. The problem is that that's not the only rematch. You have a whole pay-per-view built up of rematches. That's the issue. Kind of a strong ending to the show, but overall, not a very good episode of Raw. The stuff with Brian and Kane is absolutely mind-boggling. I don't know what they were smoking or what they were thinking when they came up with it. I understand that it was probably a last-minute thing with Batista bowing out and not wanting to lose again at the next pay-per-view, but you've got a company here with an army of writers, okay, 20, 30 people any given week putting their input in writing these shows, and that's the best you could come up with. That's pretty damn sad. That is pretty damn sad if that's the best that you could come up with for your world champion. It's pathetic. NXT this past week, really good show. If you missed it, check it out. Renee Young is now a permanent member of the announce team, we were told. So she was actually better than she's been in the past this week. And I think her being permanent, now that they've committed to it, they've made up their minds. Okay, we're not going to have her on one week and off the next. It'll be good for her. Hopefully she gets better over time. Brings some stability there to that announce desk. Charlotte and Emma had a match as part of the women's title tournament. This was the match where I mentioned earlier, Emma pulled out the pink cobra. And she tried to use it. Sasha Banks jumped up on the apron for the distraction. Emma nailed her with the cobra instead. That allowed Charlotte to use her Charlotte's Web move and get the pin on Emma. It isn't bad enough that Emma is stuck doing this stupid cobra BS on Raw and SmackDown. Now she has to do it on NXT, and she's losing matches. It's awful. It's awful. The quicker they get her away from Santino, the better off she'll be, because every single week that goes by with her doing this cobra nonsense is not doing her any good. The reason she got over, you want to know why she got over on NXT? It wasn't the bubbles. It wasn't the stupid dance. It wasn't the music. Okay? It had nothing to do with that. That stuff was just an added bonus that people got into. You know why they got into Emma? Because she could wrestle. She's a really good wrestler. She's got a brutal-looking finishing move. The kind of finishing move, even as a diva, that people pop for when she puts it on. Kind of like the finisher that Paige now uses. Which is why I think at some point Paige and Emma could be a really hot feud on the main roster. Not if they keep booking Emma to look like a goof with Santino and the pink cobra puppet nonsense. She got over because she's a good wrestler. We haven't seen any of that on TV so far. None. Not one match have we seen that she's actually a really good wrestler. And until they illustrate that point on TV, she's not going to get over. She's going to get lost in the shuffle, and she's just going to be another woman on the roster. We have two new tag teams. One is the Legionnaires, which is the team of Sylvester Lefort and Marcus Louis. French tandem there. They took on the debuting Kalisto, the former Samurai del Sol, and El Local, who is Ricardo Rodriguez under a lucha mask. It was May of last year, I had to look it up, when Kalisto signed a developmental deal with WWE. So here we are, 1 year later, he finally makes it to NXT television. He was easily the standout in this match. You know, Ricardo should get some props too, because Ricardo, when he's under the mask and he's in there doing his thing, flying around, you know, he's not the kind of guy you look at and go, wow, he's a cruiserweight guy. He's got a little bit of weight to him. He's not a huge guy. But you wouldn't expect him to fly around the ring with such ease the way he does. So I think Ricardo is underrated in that way. He should get some credit. But Kalisto was the standout in this match, all 5'6" of him. He's a small guy. He had a little flurry there at the end that was fun to watch. He got the pin on Lefort with an enziguri. Since Sin Cara was such a bust, you know, if they're looking for an heir apparent to Rey Mysterio, I think Kalisto may be the closest thing they've got. And more importantly, we've got some new tag teams on NXT at a time when they desperately need some new teams, so I'm happy to see that. Adam Rose was in the back giving a pep talk to Captain Comic, one of his Rosebuds, who was attacked by Camacho on last week's show. He wrestled Camacho here. Within seconds of the bell, Camacho gave this guy a kick to the gut, and it elicited Match of the Year chants from the NXT audience. This was a quick squash. Adam Rose ran out to save Captain Comic after the match, post-match beatdown from Camacho. So it helped further the issue between Camacho and Rose. Clearly they're building to a match, maybe at the TakeOver show on May 29th. So, you know, basic storytelling here. We have the debut of Alexa Bliss against Alicia Fox in the women's title tournament. Winner to meet Charlotte in the semifinals. Alexa Bliss is supposed to be basically a human version of Tinkerbell, to the point where they called her a fairy as she came down to the ring. It's a good thing it wasn't a dude they said that about, because they'd have GLAAD all over their asses if they did. But really, the girl is tiny. Like, even smaller than AJ Lee tiny. She's 5'1". And she blows fairy dust at the crowd during her entrance. So it's different. It's certainly different. I love the aggression from Alicia Fox during this match. I mean, Alexa Bliss looked good. It was her debut. She won. It was all about her. She won with a... what'd she win with? Like a Tilt-A-Whirl small package. They called it an upset. She's moving on to face Charlotte. But let's not take anything away from Alicia Fox. She showed a lot of aggression during this match. She's really good. You know, she's, again, I mentioned Emma earlier, who's a good wrestler. We don't really get to see it too much. You know, Alicia Fox is another one where we don't really have a chance to see much from her on TV. I don't watch Superstars. Maybe she wrestles on Superstars, but Superstars don't count. Okay, we all know what counts. Raw counts and SmackDown counts. And I don't remember the last time I saw Alicia Fox in a match of any sort of length or any sort of importance on Raw or SmackDown. But she's really, really good. She did this one spot during the match where she gave Alexa Bliss, who again is a tiny girl, she almost broke her in half. She gave her a backbreaker across her knee and then very violently just shoved her down to the mat, just the way she did it. You know, she's a violent person when she's in there. She's very good at what she does, and I don't think she gets enough credit for that. So Alexa Bliss is moving on. She'll meet Charlotte in the next round. Main event here was a 20-man over-the-top rope battle royal. The second battle royal this week, mind you, to determine the number one contender to Adrian Neville's NXT Championship at TakeOver on May 29. Danny Burch, Oliver Gray, Mason Ryan were all in this match. Still feels weird seeing guys that have been cut still wrestling on this show since it was taped weeks earlier. Same thing happened with Cassius Ohno before they released him. They got rid of him, and he was on TV for like another 3 weeks after that. You know, I just sit there the whole time thinking in my head, I see dead people. It's the only thing I could think of. Yoshitatsu was super over during this match. People wanted badly for him to win. So when Bo Dallas dumped him out, he got mega heat for doing so. Bo actually got off a string of eliminations before being thrown out by Tyson Kidd, which got him chance of thank you, Tyson. Bo Dallas not very beloved in the NXT zone, or whatever they call it, NXT arena. Tyler Breeze dropped Tyson Kidd with the beauty shot, but then he couldn't get him up to throw him out of the ring. Finishing sequence had Sami Zayn and Tyson Kidd fighting each other out on the apron. Okay, they got dumped over, but they didn't hit the floor. So now they're out on the apron. Over comes Tyler Breeze. And one thing leads to another. All three men tumble out to the floor. Sure looked to me like Tyler Breeze's feet were the last to hit. he probably should have won the match. But still, I mean, the finish, it was a hell of a finish. The way they did it was actually very well done. It was a hot finish. Three of the top guys in NXT, aside from the champion right now, Adrian Neville. And people started chanting triple threat. They wanted to see these guys wrestle to determine who the number one contender was. So out comes Triple H to announce that, in fact, it would be a triple threat match next week to determine the number one contender, which is awesome. That's going to be an awesome match. Happy to see Tyler Breeze involved in the main event picture, even if it's just for a couple of weeks. For people who haven't read the spoilers, I don't know if he's challenging Adrian Neville for the title on the 29th or not. He's got a shot, but even if he isn't, you know, the fact that he's involved here in the main event picture is pretty cool. But they need to end this JBL as general manager nonsense, because it's completely ridiculous when Triple H comes out to make all of these major announcements, yet we're supposed to believe that JBL is actually the one running the show. I think it's time to cut bait on JBL and just let Triple H be the one to go out there and make the important decisions when they have to be made. He's always there. You know, he's in the gorilla position behind the curtain backstage. Just let Triple H come out. And I love how Triple H on this show is a babyface. You know, on television, he's this evil, nefarious heel. He's with Evolution. He's with Stephanie, the Authority. You know, he comes out here. People cheer him. He says, you know, the fans know what's best for business. And he makes the announcements that kind of pop the crowd and all that kind of stuff. Very interesting. But this was a good show. If you missed it, go back and at least watch the Battle Royal. And definitely make sure that you make time for Tyler Breeze, Sami Zayn, and Tyson Kidd on next week's show. I haven't read, you know, how the match was or anything like that. I don't need to. Putting those three guys in the ring, you give them some time, they're going to have a killer match. So make sure you don't miss that one. Check this out, guys. For you, the listeners of The Sound Off, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial so that you can check out their service. And it's a quality service. I wouldn't be mentioning it on my show if it wasn't. They have a bunch of wrestling books to choose from in audio form, including Lex Luger's book, Dusty Rhodes' book, Hulk Hogan's book is available with narration from the Hulkster himself. There's even one that chronicles the rise of the late Junkyard Dog in Mid-South, which sounds really interesting. You can choose any one of those free by trying audible.com. If you commute to work, or if you like listening to things other than music at the gym, I know a lot of people listen to this podcast that way. It seems to me an audiobook would absolutely make sense. To get one, make sure you go to audibletrial.com/Solomonster. It's another way to show your support for The Sound Off, and you get something free in return. Can't beat that. Again, that's audibletrial.com/Solomonster. Time for the Impact Report. How awful were those fans in the Impact Zone on Thursday night? I don't know if it was just the last of, like, a marathon taping or what the deal was, but it was awful. I mean, they're pretty much in the same setting every single week. You know, there's not a lot of people there. It's the same place down in Orlando at Universal, which they're done with now, by the way. I don't know how many more tape shows they have in the can that are from Universal, but they're now done taping there. So I don't know what they're going to do going forward once the summer is over and they're out of New York, but they are done now at the Impact Zone, which is good news for them because the fans, like I said, were just atrocious watching the show this week. In front of that crowd, it was embarrassing. It was embarrassing to watch this show. I got my front row tickets this week to one of the TNA tapings in New York City. They're coming here back-to-back-to-back tapings at the end of June at the Manhattan Center. Not the Hammerstein Ballroom on the main floor, but upstairs in the Grand Ballroom where Raw used to be back in 93. Myself and Brian Blade, so that'll be interesting. I don't think I've ever been to a wrestling TV show, a TV taping, in the front row before. So I figured this may be my only shot. I know it's TNA, but what the hell. So that's where we'll be next month, and that should be fun. Just come to New York. Come to New York. We'll show you what a real crowd should sound like, because that crowd in Orlando was pathetic. Come to New York. Dixie, by the way, has been having a meltdown on Twitter this week. She's been getting a lot of hateful tweets from people, probably more so than usual, and she's been responding to them. Instead of blocking them or ignoring them, she's making the mistake of responding to the trolls and feeding the trolls and using some expletives on Twitter, which you usually don't see from her. And she had one very controversial tweet. She responded to a guy that, and I want to address this here, because I mentioned on Twitter when it happened, I said, oh, take a look at this. She responded to a guy who tweeted her from a phony Jim Ross account. It was clearly a parody account for JR. She knew it was a parody account because in her response she said, well, you know as little as the real JR does. So for whatever reason, she took a dig at Jim Ross. I don't know if he said something on his podcast that rubbed her the wrong way. I don't listen to his podcast every week. I did hear his most recent one, and he did have some criticism for TNA, but it was a valid criticism. It's not like he was being unfair to them in some way. He's just being honest, you know? He's not signed to a WWE contract anymore, so he's not drinking the Kool-Aid. He talks WWE, he talks TNA, he talks Ring of Honor on his show. He could talk whatever he wants to talk. He's a wrestling guy. He's not a WWE guy anymore. In fact, he got a new gig. He's going to be doing commentating for a boxing show, I think, on Memorial Day. Jim Ross is going to be a boxing announcer. But he talked about TNA on his podcast. He probably gave some constructive criticism. Maybe that's what pissed her off. And she has since deleted the tweet. So clearly she either felt bad about it or she just got so much heat over it, she took it down. But I had people tweeting me, and even on Facebook, saying, "It's a parody account. It's just a parody account." No shit, Sherlock. I wish people would read. She knew it was a parody account. She made a dig at the real JR anyway. That's what I was saying. I know that it was a parody account that tweeted her. Okay, just read. Please read. Reading comprehension, I think, is at an all-time low. Piss me off. Anyway, there were two show-long storylines on this show on Impact this week. The first one, MVP's announcement of the number one contender to Eric Young's title at Slammiversary. He announced who the number one contender for the title would be. This after an opening segment with EY and Bobby Roode, where they came to an understanding that Eric Young would give Bobby Roode one more shot on this show at the title. And if Bobby Roode couldn't win, he said, "You know what then? I don't deserve a shot. I don't deserve to be the champion." It looked like they were starting to position Roode almost as a babyface. At least I thought that was the point of the segment. As it turned out, they made the match. The segment was a complete waste of time because the very next segment, MVP told Eric Young, "Not happening. Not happening. Bobby Roode is not getting a title match on this show. But I'll tell you what, I will announce to you by the end of the show who your number one contender is going to be." And it turned out to be MVP. Ended up being a swerve. He turned heel. He attacked Eric Young. And you know it was a heel turn, because not only did he attack Eric Young, he attacked him with weapons. He used his bling, his chain, whatever it was, and he announced that he would be challenging him for the title at the next pay-per-view. The other show-long storyline involved Bully Ray going on a search for Dixie Carter in Nashville. Again, Bully has been banned from the Impact Zone by MVP, as has Dixie. So he has taken it upon himself to go all the way to Nashville, Tennessee, to find her at TNA headquarters. And they had these skits throughout the entire show where Bully entered the building. He's looking for Dixie. Rockstar Spud is there. He says, "Madam Dixie's not here. You can't go in. You can't go in." Of course, he went in. The last time I saw the anti-authority babyface go to company headquarters and hand out beers to the employees was Stone Cold and Stanford back in 99. And that was more entertaining, but these were okay. Bully, I thought, was good. Rockstar Spud was really good. His character is completely goofy, but he plays it very well. Whatever. It was what it was. It just, they're furthering whatever the stupid storyline is with Bully and Dixie. That I still maintain has to end with him putting her through a table at one of the New York City shows, or else this whole thing is completely pointless. So the opening segment, like I said, was EY and Roode, which turned out to be a waste of time because they made a match that never happened. We had the Beautiful People beating Madison Rayne and Brittany in an elimination evening gown match. That's a first. Brittany was gone first, then Velvet, who came back out later in the match and pretended to flash her tits to distract the referee. Have to talk about this. This was so stupid, and it was the same referee, Brian Stifler, I think his name is. The same referee who had the brain aneurysm at Sacrifice, okay, when Bobby Roode's foot missed him by about 5 miles and he bumped forward anyway, the greatest ref bump of all time. So all I could think here, he's looking at this woman who's clearly not naked, and he had another brain aneurysm, I guess, because he was distracted, and Angelina sprayed Madison in the eyes with hairspray, stripped her clothes off, and won the match. Somebody, please, get this fucking guy out of the ring. He is not fit to serve as a referee in TNA. Maybe he's got a medical issue. Somebody get him some help. We had EC3 and Kurt Angle, which I was kind of looking forward to. I thought, okay, these guys could have a good match. They didn't have the match on pay-per-view that time because Kurt got hurt. He had the knee surgery. And thank God for that, because at least it wasn't a cage match, or else Kurt would have died. As it turned out, this was not a match. It was an angle. They went about 2 or 3 minutes, And it ended with EC3 taking out Kurt's knee again. May have been the other knee. I don't remember. But it was really just an angle to set up, you know, the injury stuff with Kurt. We had a segment later on. Kurt had his knee checked out and was told, you need surgery. So Kurt's going away again. Kurt Angle injured. In other news, the sky is blue and water is wet. And apparently it's real. He's going to have surgery to repair the ACL. From what I read, he has no ACL in one of his knees. So maybe it's the other knee that he tore the ACL in, but it's a legitimate injury. He either had surgery or is going to have, I think he already had surgery because he tweeted a picture on Instagram that said 4 months and 29 days from my return to the ring, and it showed his leg, his knee in a brace, elevated, I guess sitting at home. So he's already on the mend, but he's going to be out for 4 to 6 months. And if it's Kurt Angle, if it's Kurt's choice, he'll be back in 4 rather than 6. But that still takes him away from TNA for most of the summer, and his contract is up, I think, in September. So I don't know what Kurt's future holds, but it's not impossible to think that we may well have seen the last of Kurt Angle in the TNA ring. Not saying we have, but it's possible. So he's going to be gone for a while. The Wolves beat the Bromans tag team ladder match to retain their TNA tag team titles. This was a good match. Some crazy spots in this match, including a double foot stomp by Davey Richards off the top rope onto Robbie E, who was laid across a ladder outside the ring. It was propped up by the barricade and maybe the steps in the ring. I don't know. It was elevated, and Robbie is laying on it. Double foot stomp off the top. You couldn't pay me enough money to take that double foot stomp. So that looked brutal. Then the Wolves were about to win the match. DJ Zima Ion runs in. Last ditch effort to try to save the match for his boys. And instead, he got hip toss off the top of the ladder, out of the ring, out onto the Bromans on the floor, who were there to catch him or save his life, really is what they did, because if they weren't there, he'd be dead right now. The crowd nearly ruined the match by not reacting to anything except the finish. It was dead silent in the impact zone. This was the match that, as I'm watching this show, it came across as so embarrassing to me. It's just sad. It resembles more and more each week a high school gym when they go there. So the fact they're not going to be back there for a while, they'll come to New York for some shows at the end of next month. They may come back to New York again in August. I think the TV will look a lot better over the summer, but then they've got to worry about what happens after that. But this is a good match that should have gotten a much better response than it did. Then we got the debut of the Menagerie. Nux, Rebel, who has some impressive assets, I have to say. Crazy Steve, dressed in clown makeup, and The Freak, who is Rob Terry in a pretty badass mask. It's like, it looks like an iron mask. It's not real iron, obviously, but I'm digging the mask. I actually think it's a good look for Rob Terry. He was never known to be a good talker, so you just put a cool-looking mask on the guy. He's ripped to shreds. He's got a great physique, obviously. I don't know that he's improved wrestling-wise, but, you know, he looked like $1 million. Covers his whole face, the mask. And I have to say, I watched this whole thing from start to finish, from their music to all of them coming out on stage. They had these guys on stilts outside the ring in each corner, or two of the corners anyway. I actually liked it. I liked the debut of the Menagerie. I liked the act. I liked the presentation of the act. There's a story there. At least they have a story. They took the time to try to tell us what that story was, which is that, you know, Nux is doing it to help send money back home to his family to, you know, prop up the carnival business, which was wrecked by a hurricane or floods, whatever the issue was. And so he's brought his old carnival buddies and his girlfriend. I had somebody tell me that Rebel is supposed to be his sister. I don't really think that's the case. I mean, as they're doing their entrance here, at one point Nux kissed his sister's foot, if that's the case. That's pretty fucked up, if that's the case. So I'm going to guess that it's not his sister. It's his girlfriend or ex-girlfriend or something like that. But I can appreciate them at least taking the time to try to tell the backstory there. And I liked it. It's only 1 week. It's only one show. But for the debut, I liked it. I liked the act. It's probably just a mid-card act at best. But still, I don't really have anything bad to say about it. What I do have something bad to say about is the fact that it was Frankie Kazarian who did the job here for Nux. And that's fine, because you got to put Nux over. He's not going to lose his first match. Why it had to be Kazarian, though, that's the reason that makes me angry. It was Kazarian because Kazarian now is done with TNA. He is officially no longer under contract as of, I don't know if it was yesterday maybe or the day before, but he is done. He did not re-sign with TNA. They clearly made no major attempt to re-sign him, because had they made a real attempt, maybe he would have stuck around. But as was the case with Chris Sabin, Chris Daniels, AJ Styles, they let these guys go. And the common thread there is that they're all TNA originals. They're not WWE retreads. These are all TNA originals who busted their ass for years and years and years for the company, got over, some more than others. In one case, it was their biggest star, their biggest babyface they let go. And now they've moved on. And from what I understand, Daniels may be ROH bound and Kazarian may join him there. So imagine, that'd be a hell of a pickup for Ring of Honor if that actually comes to fruition. If Bad Influence go to Ring of Honor, they've already got AJ Styles. They've got a nice, real good crop of talent there in Ring of Honor. And Daniels and Kazarian being brought in as a tag team, let's say, to work with the Briscoes, among others. I mean, that'd be something else. So TNA's loss may end up being ROH's gain, but it's still a loss for TNA that didn't have to be. I watched Kazarian here doing the job for this guy, and I just sat there thinking, you know, how did it get to this point? How do you let guys like that go? How do you not fight for them? How do you not do everything in your power to keep these guys around and make them more of a focal point? I mean, I know they've been more of a comedy act recently, but some of that may have been because they had a sense they were going to be on their way out anyway. How do you let guys like that go? And so watching Kazarian there, you know, doing the honors, I guess, on his way out made me very sad, because now I'm not going to get to see them on TV every single week. And they were one of the highlights for me of TNA. It seems like every week that goes by, there's fewer and fewer reasons for me to watch this show. I still enjoy parts of it. I still watch it. You know, like I said, I'll go to the shows when they come locally and I guess support them in that way. But sometimes I ask myself why. You know, why do I do that when Bobby Roode, Austin Aries, and Bad Influence were really the things that kept me watching TNA? Now Bad Influence is gone. Austin Aries seems like he's got one foot out the door. He's rarely even on television, and Bobby Roode's really the only one left. You know, it's harder and harder. So that made me very sad. But as far as the Menagerie debut goes, I know some people had some things online, you know, trashing it, and it's a copy of this or, you know, whatever. Why are they wasting all their effort on Nux? And that's a valid question, because I don't see Nux ever getting beyond a certain level. You know, Nux was not the one in Aces and Eights who got over. The one who was starting to get over in Aces and Eights was Doc Gallows, who's now over in New Japan. He's part of the Bullet Club. Ironically, Luke Gallows, you know, Doc Gallows, who was with Aces and Eights, is now partners in New Japan with AJ Styles. They're both part of the same faction, which is kind of funny. It was him. It wasn't Nux. You know, Nux never really got over, but they're trying. It's something different. It's not just Nux. They've got Rebel. They've got Crazy Steve, who I think is an independent wrestler from up in Canada. We'll see where it goes. But as far as first nights are concerned, as a debut, I actually enjoyed it. We had Willow one-on-one against Magnus. Quick match, 2 minutes. Gunner. Or Bram, I should say, because could have fooled me. They pretty much looked the same. Bram was out there, and he signed a contract, so he's official, by the way. That's the former Kenneth Cameron. He was one half of the Ascension in NXT. He got fired, got arrested a couple of times, so TNA's picked him up. They signed him to a new contract, so his name is Bram. He is old buddies from the UK with Magnus. And I don't know if the idea here is to slowly turn Magnus babyface to feud with Bram, or if Bram is just trying to give Magnus a mean streak and they're going to be a tag team. But, you know, they were wrestling, and Bram interferes. He throws Willow into the ring steps. Ref calls for the DQ, throws the match away. He throws Willow in the ring. Bram handcuffs him to the ropes. He starts beating him with like a metal pipe or a rod or something, I think, that keeps the turnbuckles together. And the whole time, Magnus is just watching, like, what are you doing, dude? Like, what's the matter with you? And Bram is like, that's how you do it. That's how you beat somebody down. So it's a little early. I don't know what direction it's going in. But Willow. Willow is laying there being beaten by this metal object. And he's screaming. Okay, but he's selling it as Willow. Which I guess, you know, maybe he should do, because he's trying to, you know, play the character. But the sight of watching Willow scream as he was selling the beatdown from Bram, he's doing this weird Willow scream, it just completely took me out of the moment. It was completely ridiculous. You know, if you're being beaten down with a metal object, okay, enough with playing Halloween. Oh, it's Jeff Hardy's alter ego. Well, we all know it's Jeff Hardy under a mask. Jeff Hardy is being beaten down with a metal object, and instead of just, you know, screaming like Jeff Hardy normally would to sell the fact that, shit, that hurts. He's doing his weird Willow screams. I mean, you want to see a Willow impression? Here's my Willow impression. Willow is being beaten down by the metal object because Willow sucks! That's my Willow impression. This gimmick sucks. Final segment was the MVP reveal, announcing himself as the number one contender, turning heel, attacking Eric Young. This was terrible. You know, so now we have two heel authority figures in TNA. As if one wasn't enough. I'm not even a fan of babyface authority figures the way they're booked these days, because they're just all over these shows, and that goes for WWE too. But now we have two heel authority figures in the same company, who I take it still don't like each other, so it's not like they're going to be aligned together, at least I hope not, because that would make no sense. But now we have two. But I do love how they piped in chants of "You suck" at MVP when nobody in the crowd was chanting it. Go back. It's up on the TNA YouTube channel. Even the non-TNA fans who just get a kick out of hearing these reviews, okay? Go find the clip on their YouTube channel. It's like, yeah, 3 minutes long. They have the whole segment here. And pay attention to the crowd, and pay attention to the crowd noise. They're chanting, "You suck," but nobody's lips are moving. The only thing they're chanting, they're actually chanting MVP's name. That's what they were chanting. So they had a pipe in crowd noise here. Plus, I have to say this. And I have no ill will towards either one of these men. I actually like Taz. Taz has a new podcast out. The funny thing is, Taz has a new podcast, I think, on Monday nights where he reviews Raw, which is kind of funny. But I have to say, the commentary here during this segment was absolutely awful. And I don't know if it's just the stuff that they had to say, or just maybe it was the way that they were saying it, but there was no real enthusiasm behind it. It was, you know, Mike Tenay especially, and I'm sure Mike Tenay is a nice guy. You know, I'm not a hater of Mike Tenay. I'm just not a real big fan of his commentary in TNA at all. And I think he's been doing it there for so long, and this company has had this negative stench attached to it for so long that sometimes there's something to be said for freshening things up. I don't know who the person would be that you would replace him with. You know, Jeremy Borash, the times that he stepped in, has been very good at more as a color guy. I don't know that Borash should be carrying the show as a play-by-play guy, but this was terrible. You know, this was, and maybe part of the problem is, in my head, I keep thinking of Jim Ross, how he would call this segment, and how appalled he would be at MVP turning on Eric Young, and how disingenuous he was, and now he's beating him down with a chain and all that kind of stuff. It's like it didn't even matter. It was just oh, look at this, MVP. How dare MVP? How could he do this? Like, the commentary was terrible. It just took me out of the moment. Everything about this segment was just a fail. It was just no good. So now they're building to an MVP Eric Young match at Slammiversary. That's going to be the main event at their next big pay-per-view. I'm not against the idea of doing something with MVP. Remember, MVP did not sign a contract with TNA just to be an authority figure. You know, at some point you figured he was going to get involved, he was going to start wrestling more often, he was going to be involved in a main storyline, and this happens to be it. They signed him, now they're going to push him into the main event. I don't know if they're going to put the title on him or not. I suppose it's possible. I wouldn't do that. And you'd have people coming out of the woodwork saying, oh, there you go, ex-WWE guy putting their world title on him. I don't think MVP is that great. I don't see MVP as being a world champion. So I would almost rather they just keep the title on Eric Young and keep building him up. But, you know, the swerve and the way they did this and the commentary, just everything about this was a fail. And I just wasn't into any of it at all. In fact, I think the thing that I enjoyed the most on this show may have been the debut of the Menagerie, and I never would have said that going in, but coming out of it, that was probably the one thing that put a smile on my face more than anything else. As a wrestling show, it was terrible. It was terrible. The longest match was the tag match, and that went way less than 10 minutes. Probably went 7 or 8 minutes, and that was the longest match in the entire show. Everything else was just a bunch of swerves, no DQ, Or DQs, I should say, 2-minute match, 3-minute match, evening gown match, you know, the EC3 Kurt thing, which wasn't even much of a match. It just was not a good show. This is a company that is lacking momentum, alarmingly so. And they really, it's almost a shame the New York shows aren't until the end of next month, because I think they really need to get their ass to New York right now, or Chicago, or some market where people will actually show some enthusiasm. And at least the shows then would come off as hot, even if they really weren't. I read some of the taping results, not all of them, and because the shows for the next month are already in the can. They're already taped at the Impact Zone, so I don't think the crowd reaction is going to get much better. And I'm reading through some of this stuff and, you know, booking like an 8-man tag team first blood match. Like, this company is so fucked. They got to get their act together. How do you even book an 8-man tag team first blood? Why am I even trying to make sense of this? Let's move on to the mailbag here. If you have questions, you can email them to me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. You can also send in MP3 audio questions as attachments. Please include the text of your question in the body of the email. You can email me, and also when you do so, please include your name and where you are from. We have an audio question actually to start things out here from Nate in Hutchinson, Minnesota.
Hey, Solomon Monster, it's Nate from Hutchinson, Minnesota. My question today is in regards to John Cena. Is it possible for him to get any more over? I mean, you have the half the crowd yelling for him and half the crowd yelling against him, and it's correlating into a huge pop. I mean, it might not be the best reaction, but it is a reaction. So, is it possible for him to get any more over?
I don't know. I don't know if over is the right word. You may be using the wrong word there. Popular? Sure. He can get more popular. I don't know how you do that unless you tweak the character, turn him heel, do something different. But he's already over. I mean, he's been over for how many years now, you know, from the time he won the championship. And he's already in that level where, you know, he's going to be one of the biggest stars of all time when all is said and done. He's going to be up there with the names of Hogan and Austin and Rock and Brett and Shawn and all those top stars. He'll be in that upper echelon. He's the face of this current generation, the last 10 years. He's been the man, like Hogan was in his era, Austin in his era. Cena has not been as popular as those two guys, but he is the most popular guy of this era. So for him to be any more over, I think that maybe is the wrong word. Popular, yes. But it's not going to be easy unless they really tweak that whole character. And clearly they don't want to do that right now because he's the golden goose and you don't want to screw over the golden goose. So there you go. This comes from Trent. I'm very curious as to whether you think CM Punk will get a Hall of Fame nod. Not next year anytime soon, but ever. I'm hopeful that Savage headlines the Hall of Fame next year. But will CM Punk, given his sticky note standing with the company right now, get the Randy Savage treatment down the line, continually excluded over and over because he left him high and dry? No, I think he'll get in at some point, and I'm not even convinced he won't be back wrestling with them at some point. I think he will be. But is that going to be next year? Is that going to be 2 years from now? Nobody knows. Nobody knows. I think in his mind, probably he's retired right now, but forever is a long time. So he'll be in the Hall of Fame at some point because there's money to be made. And, you know, time heals all wounds, whatever the issues are right now between the two sides. You know, Punk can be upset about any number of things, but at the end of the day, that company still made him a lot of money. They made him a big star. They made him a lot of money. He got to work with a lot of guys that I'm sure he liked working with. They put the belt on him for over a year. He got to work with Heyman. All these things that Punk got to do that he would not have been able to do anywhere else. I would think at some point he'll come back and get that Hall of Fame nod, even if it's 5 years from now. Absolutely, he'll be in the Hall of Fame. Juan from Bowling Green, Ohio, who has been listening to this show since that very first 7-minute sound off I did back in 2007. I've been watching the evolution of Alexander Rusev since his days on NXT until now as a member of the main roster, and now he's being announced as residing in Russia. It made me think of Vladimir Kozlov and his initial run as the Moscow Mauler. Is the current Alexander Rusev character what WWE had originally intended for Kozlov? What has made Rusev successful so far that Kozlov has lacked? So far, yes, he's been okay. I think it's too early to say whether or not Rusev is successful or not. What makes him different, you know, when Kozlov debuted, he did those things. He was sitting in the crowd. They interviewed him, and he was like, "I love WWE." It was almost like he was being played for comedy at first. And then when he debuted, they pushed him as a serious guy. He even had a pay-per-view main event against Triple H. Or maybe it was Triple H and Edge at a Survivor Series. That was awful. It was horrendous. He just wasn't very good. You know, he used to be like a big Sambo guy and like a big fight guy. He could do certain things. He was a tough guy. But as a wrestler, he really wasn't very good. Rusev, from what I've seen, because I've seen him on NXT from his start until now, I remember when he debuted. I don't remember who he wrestled, but I remember him debuting and his look back then, and he had like curly hair and everything, and he's actually very good. And as big guys go, he's got the power moves down. He can move around pretty quickly in there. As a wrestler, if you compare him to Kozlov, I already think Rusev is light years ahead of Kozlov. So I think he's got a lot more potential than Kozlov did. Kozlov ended up being successful as a comedy character. Him and Santino were great together. But as far as the character itself, I don't know that it's the same character that was intended. Because like I said, when he debuted, he was sitting in the front row talking about double double E. Rusev lets Lana do the talking for him. He goes in there, he beats people up. It's a different character, so I don't think one really has anything to do with the other. Kelly from Long Island, he only recently started watching wrestling again. He's been trying to get caught up on stuff from the last 5 years or so. Stumbled on this podcast. Thinks it's one of the better ones out there, so thank you to Kelly. I was wondering how you felt about the Billy and Chuck tag team, and do you think a similar bromance gimmick would work today? Well, we have the Bromans and TNA, if you want to check them out. I was not a huge fan of Billy and Chuck. It just didn't do anything for me. But I have to say, Billy and Chuck were part of one of the greatest segments in WWE television ever. That goes for Raw, SmackDown, any show. I heard Eric Bischoff, maybe on Twitter, somebody asked him about it recently. Because Eric Bischoff was part of that angle, the Billy and Chuck wedding on SmackDown. And Bischoff, through all the stuff that Bischoff has done in his career, including all the NWO stuff in WCW, he says that was the best thing he was ever involved with on a wrestling show. That was so awesome, the way they pulled that off. If you've never seen it, it was back in like 2003, and Billy and Chuck were getting married. They were managed by Rico, and they were supposed to be, you know, they were supposed to be this gay tag team, and they were going to get married. And it was going to be a situation where they wouldn't actually go through with it. It was all going to be just for show, and Bischoff was dressed up in prosthetics as this old guy, as the reverend or the minister or whatever you call it. Nobody knew that it was Bischoff. It did not look anything like him, unlike Dixie at the Sacrifice pay-per-view a few weeks ago, where as soon as she came walking out there in that disguise, she got a chance of Dixie sucks. Nobody knew that it was Bischoff under all the prosthetics. The way they did this was awesome. And when they had the big reveal moment where he started peeling off parts of his face, it was awesome. It was great. It was this great, shocking moment because they had this rivalry going on at the time between GMs. You know, Bischoff was the GM of Raw. Stephanie was the GM of SmackDown. So it was Raw trying to sabotage SmackDown. So Bischoff reveals himself to be the minister or whatever. And all of a sudden, out comes 3-minute warning. Rosie and Jamal beating up Billy and Chuck. Stephanie is appalled. Bischoff grabs her so she can't do anything. Then he throws Stephanie into, I think it was Jamal. He gives her a Samoan drop. It's just complete chaos. Out come all the SmackDown guys from the locker room, Kurt Angle and everybody else, to chase the Raw guys and Bischoff through the crowd. They really did a good job of building up a rivalry between the two brands back when they actually did a brand split the correct way, or as close to doing it the correct way as they ever did it. But that whole angle was awesome. I love that. The Billy and Chuck team, not so much. But the angle was great. Canadian Dynamite, Cole Bloxham from Rocky Mountain House in Alberta, Canada, recently purchased the WrestleMania Anthology DVDs, and the first ones I watched were the ones from the Attitude Era, 15, 16, and 17. My question to you is, as a whole, did these WrestleManias underachieve? I ask this because although 17 is highly regarded, the other two were underwhelming for the talent and the company that they had at the time. WrestleMania 15 was loaded with many non-finishes and bizarre booking. The show did have the first Stone Cold vs. Rock title match, but that was not enough to save the show. 16 did have the first TLC match, but everything else on the card sucked. The show did not have one singles marquee match. Didn't have any singles matches, actually, on that show. It wasn't just that they didn't have a marquee match. There were no singles matches. It's the only WrestleMania in history to not have a single one-on-one match on the entire pay-per-view. So, anyway, he says 16 had not one singles marquee match, with the main event being a very underwhelming fatal four-way elimination match. 16 was very disappointing. 16 was very, very disappointing. I agree. And it should have been Rock versus Triple H in the main event. 15 was... I don't like 15 too much. I'm not a fan of WrestleMania 15. But 15 kind of... illustrated what the Attitude Era was. You know, that was an Attitude Era WrestleMania. You had Stone Cold and The Rock in the main event. You had a lot of gimmicks, a lot of bullshit. You had swerves, right? You had Triple H and Kane with China helping Triple H. Then later on in the show, when Shane McMahon wrestled X-Pac, Triple H, and China come out, they turn on X-Pac. So that was a whole swerve to get Triple H over to the corporation and turn him heel. They had a hardcore match, a hardcore three-way. I think it was Holly, Billy Gunn, and maybe Al Snow was the other one. You had the Brawl for All debacle with Butterbean knocking out Bart Gunn. You had an awful Hell in a Cell, maybe the worst Hell in a Cell of all time between Undertaker and Big Boss Man, which was terrible. And they did the gimmick at the end where Boss Man was hung from a noose. That really was the Attitude Era in a nutshell. The Attitude Era was all of that stuff. It was the hardcore stuff. It was the over-the-top stuff, the Ministry, the Corporation, Stone Cold, The Rock, Brawl for All. It probably was what that WrestleMania you would expect it to be. So I don't know that I could call it underwhelming. I think it was exactly what it probably should have been. That was the Attitude Era in a nutshell. And maybe that just goes to show you that not everything about the Attitude Era was so great. Some people romanticize about, oh, I wish it could be the Attitude Era again. And they forget that not everything about the Attitude Era was all that good. It was a fun time to be a wrestling fan because everybody seemed pissed off. Everybody was pissed off at each other. And the main eventers, it wasn't a joke. They didn't come out and cut joke. I mean, The Rock had his little, you know, his catchphrases and all that kind of stuff. But The Rock never came out and was all, like, jokey with a big smile on his face. There was some lighthearted comedy with Rock and Mankind. But at the end of the day, they kicked people's asses, man. Austin came out there, he kicked your ass. The Undertaker came out, he kicked your ass. Kane, same thing. And if you weren't into that, you had a little bit of something else. You had DX for some comic relief. You had The Godfather. You had Val Venus. Everybody had a gimmick. Everybody had something going on. But not everything was great. The wrestling back during the Attitude Era was not that good. You compare the actual in-ring wrestling from the Attitude Era to the in-ring wrestling today. Today blows it away. Blows it away. But the matches back then, especially like the big pay-per-view main events, like Austin against pretty much whoever, was a lot of fun. It was a brawl. There were a lot of weapons, there was a lot of interference, but the crowds were going crazy, which just goes to show how a hot crowd can make a show or a match seem that much better. You had the Monday Night Wars going on, even though WWF was pretty much running away with it at that point. It wasn't just them. You could always flip onto the other channel if you wanted to and watch WCW, although by the end, I don't know why you would want to. So it was just a different time. But yeah, people tend to romanticize a lot about the Attitude Era, forgetting that there was a lot of really bad crap that came, you know, during that time. Justin writes in, you mentioned the WrestleMania 20 match last week, and I wanted to get your opinion on this. Which match was the most disappointing? Goldberg versus Brock Lesnar at WrestleMania 20, or Hulk Hogan versus Sting at Starrcade 97? That's a great question. But you know what? I probably would have to give the nod to Sting versus Hogan. And the reason being, Sting versus Hogan at Starrcade was a match that was built up for over a year. They built that match up month after month after month. And it's funny to me now because at the time, you know, I didn't know a lot of what was going on behind the scenes at the time, even though, you know, newsletters and stuff were out there. Now I can go back and read old copies of The Observer or The Torch or whatever and get the backstories to what was going on at the time. And there were one or two different points during the build-up in like early 97 where the plan was to have Sting wrestle. I think at one of the, maybe it was Uncensored, one of the early year pay-per-views, they were going to do a deal where Sting would have a team of people against, you know, the NWO team. And they didn't do it for reasons that involved Roddy Piper. Piper ended up having his own team, and it just didn't happen. But just to think that it wasn't their plan from day one to keep Sting out for over a year and build the Starrcade, it just happened to work out that way. Had they had their way, Sting probably would have been on television wrestling a hell of a lot earlier than he was. But it worked out well because it built up the match that much more. By the time Starrcade rolled around in 97, people were dying to see him beat the crap out of Hulk Hogan. You know, that pay-per-view did the biggest buy rate of any WCW pay-per-view before or after. Had like 600,000, I think, people or 700,000 people bought that show, which for a WCW pay-per-view was like unheard of back then. Now, the match itself sucked. Goldberg versus Lesnar also sucked. But because the match with Hogan and Sting was built up for so much longer, it was that much more of a disappointment. I think it was probably impossible for them at that point to live up to expectations. You build a match up for over a year, you better come through with a hell of a match, and that's going to be hard to do with Hulk Hogan in there. And Sting, who hadn't wrestled, maybe he did some house show matches that I'm not aware of, but for all intents and purposes, Sting was kept out of the ring and was probably very rusty because he hadn't wrestled in over a year. Goldberg versus Lesnar, they started building it up, 2 months before? I know they did it. They did the tease at Survivor Series, like one of those backstage deals where they kind of bump into each other, and it's like, this could be a WrestleMania match here. But it wasn't until the Royal Rumble, I think, that they really kicked off the build to Brock versus Goldberg. So they built it up for 2 months. Everybody knew both guys were leaving. They got a horrible reaction from the crowd. It was a boring match. Goldberg won, and they both disappeared after that. Both matches were terrible. Both matches were terrible, but it was built up for 2 months as compared to what? 13, 14, maybe 15 months? It's a big difference there. Finally, Frank from Rochester, New York. What are your thoughts on Shelton Benjamin? In 2004 and 5, he showed that he had great potential to be more than just an IC champion. He had some good matches with the likes of Triple H, Ric Flair, and Shawn Michaels, just to name a few. In my opinion, he is a great wrestler and a decent talker, but I felt they could have done more with him, but killed his momentum when WWE made him a mama's boy. Yeah, maybe they did. Maybe they gave up on him a little too quickly. You say he was a decent talker. That's being generous. I mean, Shelton Benjamin was never a good promo. He, even just as a fan watching, I'm no expert on promos, but he really wasn't that good. And to them, that's very important. You have to be able to speak. You have to have something about you that is exciting or interesting. Shelton was a great wrestler, and that was about it. He was a very athletic guy. There really wasn't much else there. His promos weren't getting any better, and they just felt this is not acceptable. We have to make him interesting. So let's put this giant woman with him, and we'll pretend that it's his mom, and people will laugh at him, and it'll make him entertaining. It's all about sports entertainment. Didn't work out too well for Shelton. So he's a great wrestler, but there really wasn't much else that they could do with him. So he's been doing his thing now in New Japan. He was with ROH for a while, but just never really lived up to the potential that he had. I mean, he could have been a lot bigger than he was, but he didn't have all the tools that they were looking for. And, for better or worse, that's just how it is. Had Shelton come along 25 years ago, would he have become a bigger star? I don't know. Back then, size was more important. Shelton was never like a big, big guy. So he probably would have been mid-card at best even 25 years ago. I don't know that there is any era that Shelton Benjamin would have been a top, like, number one or two guy.
History has been made here!
This week in wrestling history, this is going to be a big segment here. This may be the biggest This Week in History segment I've done. There's a lot of stuff that happened this week, and I want to go into detail on some of it. For the first one, we're going to go back over a century. 109 years ago, to be exact, May 5th, 1905, at Madison Square Garden in New York City, George Hackenschmidt beat Tom Jenkins 2 straight falls in a match to become the world catch-as-catch-can heavyweight champion. Whenever you would hear them say, like in WCW, that the world heavyweight title traces its roots back to 1905, it's this match they're referring to. But the thing is, it's greatly stretching the truth to insinuate any sort of real lineage between that title that Hackenschmidt won and any modern-day title. There really is no link between them. They like to say there is, but there really isn't. 25 years ago this week, on May 7, 1989, NWA held its Wrestle War Music City Showdown pay-per-view in Nashville with Ric Flair pinning Ricky Steamboat to win back the NWA World Heavyweight title in the third and final match of their epic series of matches that year. Probably the best three matches, trio of matches in a year that have ever took place. If you were not a fan back then, if you're a younger fan, you've never seen those matches before, go back and Google it, YouTube it, whatever you have to do. Buy Flair's DVDs, I'm sure it's on there, and watch those three matches. One was from the Clash of the Champions. There's the Wrestle War match. I think the first one was the Chi-Town Rumble. Was that the other one, I think? But great series of matches. And they had judges at ringside here to determine the winner of the match, had it gone the one full hour time limit. Judges were Terry Funk, Pat O'Connor, and Lou Thesz, all former champions. And after the match, Terry Funk attacked Ric Flair. Flair had turned down his request for a title shot, so he did the only thing that any rational human being would do. He gave the guy a pile driver on a table at ringside. 20 years ago this week, on May 9th, 1994, here's something I think is really cool because even I didn't know this until this week. I learned stuff here just like you guys do sometimes. WWF had a tour of Japan, and that tour included a stop in Osaka. And the main event of that show was an 18-man Royal Rumble match. The only one that WWE has ever held, I think anywhere overseas, certainly in Japan. Match went over 45 minutes, ended with The Undertaker eliminating Bam Bam Bigelow for the win. So to all you people who think that 2007 was the one and only time Undertaker ever won a Royal Rumble, you're wrong. Other matches on the show included Bret Hart and Macho Man Randy Savage beating Owen Hart and Adam Bomb, Alundra Blaze beating Bull Nakano to retain her women's title, and Yokozuna wrestling Tenryu to a double countout. 12 years ago this week, on May 5th, 2002, the World Wrestling Federation officially got the F out and became World Wrestling Entertainment. I know a dark day for many of you guys. So here's what happened, because I still get questions about this to this day. So let's just lay the whole story out here about how we got to this point. The World Wildlife Fund predated the World Wrestling Federation, okay? The Wildlife Fund was founded in 1961. In 1963, Vince Sr. and Toots Mont split from the NWA, and they created the Worldwide Wrestling Federation. That was the full name of the promotion until 1979 when they shortened it, okay? This is the WWWF. So in 79, they shortened the name. Now it's just WWF. I'm a little fuzzy on what happened in the years that followed because the two groups, they coexisted with the same initials until 1994 when they reached an agreement on how Vince McMahon would use the WWF initials. Why it took until 1994, I'm not sure. My guess would be that the Panda people had already filed a lawsuit against them over the name many years earlier, or maybe they threatened to, but that's just a guess. Anyway, they reached an understanding that Titan Sports would stop using the WWF initials and do everything in their power not to even speak the initials. Don't even verbally say the initials on TV. Okay, I guess they were okay with them verbally saying World Wrestling Federation and spelling it out because then there could be no confusion in the marketplace about what they were talking about. I don't know. I guess they were worried if Vince McMahon went on TV and said WWF, you know, people would be confused and they would think they were watching, whales and walruses fucking or something. I don't know. So, in exchange, the wildlife folks agreed not to sue them or make them change their logo. Well, obviously, Vince kept saying WWF on television for many more years and completely ignored the agreement. So, fast forward until 2000... Panda people said, enough's enough. They filed suit against WWF in a UK court, claiming that it's unfair trade practices. They alleged that they violated their earlier agreement. In August of 2001, the court ruled in favor of the wildlife people, and WWF filed an appeal in October of that year, okay, because they weren't happy with that ruling. I believe the appeal was still pending in May of 2002, when WWF decided to just drop the appeal and go through with changing its name. Very quietly, overnight, they changed the website from WWF.com to WWE.com. All references were changed. Clearly, they had decided sometime earlier to give up the good fight and just make the change. My understanding has always been that the UK court ruling would have only applied to international use of the initials. So, in other words, WWF, they could have continued to market themselves as the World Wrestling Federation here in the States, but elsewhere in the world, they couldn't. And obviously, you know, that would be very confusing to call yourself one name here and another name somewhere else, so they just said, the hell with it, let's just change the whole name. That didn't end things between the two sides. Panda people tried to get hundreds of millions of dollars in damages, but that got shot down. I think WWE claimed the wildlife folks were trying to extort them out of money, which, you know, may be true, but it seems pretty clear the Wildlife Fund had the WWF initials first, and that Titan violated the agreement, so they're kind of right. I'm guessing WWE paid them a whole bunch of money in the last year or two with the new network launching, because now they can air the old Scratch logo from the Attitude Era. And verbal WWF references on the network without blurring them or muting them. They couldn't do that before. All those DVDs with the blurs and the muting, it was terrible. Thankfully, now they don't have to do that. Although, I'm still very confused about some things like what's allowed and what's not allowed, because, you know, Legends House started airing on the network a few weeks ago. And that first, I think the first two episodes of Legends House, Jimmy Hart was wearing some kind of WWE shirt that had, I think, the old Scratch logo on it, or maybe the old box letter logo on it, which at one time was fine. That box letter logo from the mid-90s New Generation era was fine. Now, all of a sudden, I think they blur it, and I'm not sure why. I don't know if that's a case where Legends House was filmed 2 years ago, before WWE reached, let's say, whatever agreement they reached with the Panda people, saying, listen, we're launching a network. How much money do you want? We'll pay you, and please let us use this without having to blur it. It's possible they taped this show before they reached an agreement with the Wildlife Fund, or maybe they're just, there's still certain logos they're not allowed to use. I'm just not sure. But that hopefully gives you a better sense of exactly what went down between the two sides. The very next day, on May 6, 2002, the infamous plane ride from hell took place, which was a 7-hour flight from the UK back to the States, where a bunch of WWE guys got all drunk and stupid, and Brock Lesnar and Mr. Perfect wrestled in the aisle of the plane. They had just had their Insurrection pay-per-view, which was a UK-only pay-per-view, that weekend, which was the last WWF pay-per-view event of any kind. Little trivia note for you. And they were flying back home for Raw. I think Raw was in Connecticut the next night, I think I read. And Jim Ross, who was head of talent relations at the time, had this to say about the incident after it happened. Okay, because he used to post blogs online. Jim Ross said, the flight was low-lighted by a handful of people who consumed too much alcohol and consequently acted like children whose parents were away and left the liquor cabinet unlocked. The conduct of this inebriated minority was unacceptable and will not be tolerated. Procedures have been put in place to ensure such conduct does not occur in the future. The bottom line is this. Yours truly is the person in charge of the talent roster, and the buck stops with me. Among the incidents that he is referring to that took place, Kurt Hennig and Brock Lesnar, who were actually very close friends, got into an amateur wrestling match on the plane after Hennig, he kept goading Brock and just teasing him and pushing him and pushing him about who the better amateur wrestler was, until finally they just went at it and had to be broken up. Fit Finlay, I think Triple H and Paul Heyman were the ones to break it up. Hennig got fired from the company because of it. Goldust started serenading his ex-wife Terry over the loudspeaker on the plane to the point where Jim Ross had to tell him to stop. Michael Hayes allegedly got into a fight with Bradshaw, which later on led to Sean Waltman cutting off Hayes' trademark mullet while he was sleeping. Ric Flair was either dancing around naked in the aisleways, or he was merely exposing himself to one of the flight attendants, depending on who you believe. Scott Hall was completely out of it, although Jim Ross claimed that Scott Hall behaved himself on the plane. That's what he says, but supposedly Hall was out of it, and he got fired from the company right after it happened, so obviously he did something wrong. Some flight attendants filed lawsuits against them, which were settled out of court. And to this day, I believe there is no alcohol served on any WWE charter flights, and it goes back to this one. It actually sounds like a hell of a party, I have to tell you, but just not at 35,000 feet in the air. 12 years ago this week, on May 8th, 2002, the very first press release was sent announcing the debut of a new promotion called NWA Total Nonstop Action Wrestling, which started out as a weekly Wednesday night pay-per-view series, has evolved into what is now TNA Impact Wrestling. Press release had Dixie Carter listed as the PR contact, which is what she did prior to her involvement in wrestling. She ran her own public relations firm. The release stated that the premiere date would be June 19th. It would feature nationally and world-renowned superstars from the National Wrestling Alliance, the oldest professional wrestling sanctioning body in the world. Appearing on the initial programs will be top names such as former world champion Jeff Jarrett, former UFC champion Ken Shamrock, NWA legends Dory Funk Jr. and Harley Race, hardcore midget Puppet, Puerto Rican sensation Apollo, and young high flyer AJ Styles. These top athletes, representing a diverse array of wrestling styles, will be joined by the luscious TNA Girls, it's quite the original name, as well as other top free agent wrestlers from around the world who will be announced in the weeks to come. In addition, superstars from both the entertainment and sporting worlds, as well as infamous celebrities, will make guest appearances on a regular basis to create this new multifaceted approach to wrestling entertainment. First broadcast will feature country music superstar Toby Keith, and current NASCAR Winston Cup point leader Sterling Martin. Hey, Jeff Jarrett and Toby Keith involved in a new upstart wrestling promotion. There's something I've never heard of before. 9 years ago this week, on May 10th, 2005, WWE suspended Jim Cornette after a few incidents at Ohio Valley Wrestling in Louisville. OVW was their developmental territory at the time, their primary one anyway. There was a TV taping where Cornette cut a promo on Kevin Fertigue, who was the former Mordecai and future Kevin Thorne. He cut a promo on him, I guess, backstage for wearing a baseball hat during a dark match. More memorable than that, though, was the incident involving a young Santino Marella, who was just a student at the time, and the Boogeyman. And to set this up, let me play some audio for you. This is from a Q&A that Cornette did at the NWA Fan Fest 5 years ago.
I slapped Santino Marella 17 times.
It was 16, right?
It was 16 or 17. You were there. Was anybody counting, or were they just running? We're doing Ohio Valley Wrestling Television. It is a wrestling school where people come to learn to be professional wrestlers. We're doing the TV show. The forces up north have sent me the Boogeyman. Now, I was running a professional wrestling show, and they want me to use a guy who's never wrestled in front of an audience before, who's named the Boogeyman, and that's all they give me. Okay, he's never had a match, he's 40 years old, and we call him the Boogeyman. Use him. All right. So I decided, instead of having him in matches, that I would create the aura around the Boogeyman that, look, we announced on television, I said, ladies and gentlemen, I want you to know that there is a gentleman who has been coming onto the Ohio Valley Wrestling property, coming to the matches, coming to the arena. He wants to be a professional wrestler. We believe he is mentally ill and he has a serious anger management issue. He's had problems in the past. He's got a legal background. If you see this man who believes he is the Boogeyman, let an OVW official know, you know, don't approach him. Just trying to create some kind of aura around this guy so the people wouldn't think, okay, Cornette's trying to tell me this is the Boogeyman, right? No, I'm trying to tell you this motherfucker thinks he's the Boogeyman. That's the nature.
So that's the setup to what happened. I have to say, that actually is very clever on Cornette's part. You know, he's trying to make, you know, chicken salad out of chicken shit here. He's got this guy with this unbelievable gimmick. He's trying to book a wrestling promotion. So he comes up with the idea that the guy is mentally ill. If you see him, don't approach him. That's cool, because that then creates this aura of, okay, this guy is dangerous. You should be worried, and you should be afraid of him. Okay, so that's actually really cool. So what ended up happening was, they have the whole thing set up. Boogeyman can't wrestle for shit, but he's a good promo, according to Cornette. They do this thing where he's going to come up through the ring during a match. And when he does, what's going to end up happening is he's going to come out of the ring and he's going to be chasing after people. And they have, by one of the fire exits, a whole bunch of their OVW students who are all, you know, they know exactly what their job is. When Boogeyman comes over, they scatter and they run for their lives. And that's what happened, except for this one guy, that being Santino Marella, who just sat there with his arms crossed, kind of laughing. He laughed off the Boogeyman instead of showing fear. So what happened is, backstage after the event, Cornette's just going nuts. And Boogeyman is pissed beyond belief because he did everything in his power to get this guy to run away. When Santino didn't run away, Boogeyman started shaking the guardrail. He was doing all of these things, clearly waiting for this guy to run, and he never did. So after the segment or the show or whatever, they go backstage and Cornette says to somebody, is that guy one of ours? Is he one of our students? And they say, yeah. He goes, bring him to me. And they bring Santino over to him. And he said, why the hell didn't you run? And he says, well, nobody told me to. And Cornette just explodes. He says, nobody told you to. Everybody else ran away. Didn't you think that if they did, you should probably do the same thing? And he's going, he's just chewing this guy out in front of everybody. And Boogeyman's standing there. And Cornette's doing everything in his power to chew this guy out, let him know he made a mistake. But in Cornette's words, he saved Santino's life. Because when he was done, he told him to get out of there. And from his perspective, he stopped the Boogeyman from doing some horrible things to a young Santino Marella. So that's how he justifies it. But yeah, he slapped him around. He paintbrushed him around a few times. And probably shouldn't have done that. And he got a call from Johnny Ace later on saying, you can't be putting your hands on the students. And what ended up happening was Cornette got suspended. And that suspension pretty much ended his run with WWE. He was gone shortly thereafter. He went to TNA, I think, the following year. And he hasn't been back since to WWE, and I don't think he will be back to WWE. He probably deserves a Hall of Fame induction one day, but he's one of those personalities who still, you know, he speaks his mind, and he's had a lot of horrible things to say about Vince, about the McMahons, about WWE. So he may be in that Macho Man camp of, you know, let's not put this guy in the Hall of Fame because we don't want to have anything to do with this guy. But that was the unraveling of Jim Cornette's relationship in WWE, and it goes back to the incident with Santino where Santino just no-sold the boogeyman. Cornette slapped him around backstage to teach him a lesson, and that's just something you don't do. 7 years ago this week on May 8th, 2007, at a SmackDown taping in Pittsburgh, The Undertaker, torn biceps and all, went to a draw in a steel cage match with Batista for the world title when both men climbed down from the cage at the exact same time. So the same finish I talked about earlier with that NXT Battle Royal. Both feet hit the floor at the same time. Mark Henry comes out. He attacks The Undertaker, leaves him laying. Edge comes out, the ultimate opportunist. Cashes in his second Money in the Bank briefcase. That's the second briefcase of his career he has successfully cashed in. Pinning The Undertaker, winning the World Heavyweight Championship for the first time, and officially becoming part of the SmackDown brand, a brand that he made his own. He took that brand and carried it on his back for years after that. Edge became SmackDown. When I think back to SmackDown during that era, I associate Edge's face with that era, the same way I associate Triple H and the Reign of Terror with Raw from that, you know, 2002 to 2004 period. So Edge took SmackDown and made it his own, and it was the best thing that could have happened to the guy because it was getting him away from John Cena and getting him away from Triple H, who were dominating Raw. Edge would not have broken through with those guys at the top. Going to SmackDown was what he needed, and I think things worked out pretty well for him. 6 years ago this week, on May 10th, 2008, Ring of Honor made its debut in New York City's Hammerstein Ballroom, setting a new company attendance record with an event called A New Level. And this coming Saturday, Ring of Honor will be back in the Hammerstein for one of its biggest shows ever, the War of the Worlds show with New Japan Pro Wrestling. I will be there, as I was for their Hammerstein debut. And I certainly can't wait. And by the way, I will obviously talk about the show and have results next week on the Sound Off. But yeah, that's coming up this Saturday. I'm looking forward to it. And finally, 3 years ago this week, on May 6th, 2011, on the first episode of SmackDown following the Extreme Rules pay-per-view, Christian defended his newly won World Heavyweight Championship for the very first time in a match against Randy Orton and lost the title. The match was taped 2 days after the pay-per-view. So if you want to be real technical about it, Christian had the title for 2 days. He had a two-day reign as champion, but it didn't air until Friday, so they call it 5 days. It was a great match. Pretty much all of the matches those two guys had that year were great. It was easily the feud of the year in wrestling in 2011. They did not have a bad match on TV out of the eight or however many they had, but you had a lot of very pissed-off wrestling fans after Christian lost the title. There was a huge uproar online, people starting petitions, which are always very effective, by the way. If you want to waste your life and waste your time, the quickest and easiest way to do it is to start one of those online petitions. So that's what people were doing, and how disrespectful to Christian. He finally has his moment, and they take it away from him. And it certainly got people very involved emotionally. They wanted to see Christian get the belt back, and he did, although it wasn't for a few months, and I think he won it off a DQ when I think Randy Orton kicked him in the crotch, and the stip was that the title could change hands on a DQ. So not the most noble way to win a championship, but still, Christian will go down as a two-time World Heavyweight Champion, so we could all relax. And that was this week in wrestling history. You can email questions for the mailbag to me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. So keep sending those in. Follow me on Twitter, @solemonster is the place to go. We're all over Facebook as well. You can friend me on there. My name is The Solemonster. I have an extra E in my name because I'm very Shakespearean on the Facebook. We're on YouTube. You can look up videos from the Solemonster Sounds Off channel. My username on there is The Solemonster, all one word, if you want to subscribe. We are actually, you know what? I have not checked in a few days. Let me check right now to see where we are as far as subscribers on YouTube. We were getting pretty close to 8,000. 79.95. That's what we're at now. So if 5 of you guys subscribe to the YouTube channel right now, we will break 8,000. So if you haven't done that already, get right on that. So that'll do it for episode 327. I'm out. I'm going to go celebrate Mom's Day like many of you are. We'll be back with a new episode next weekend, 328. Have a review of the ROH War of the Worlds show and all the other stuff going on. The next great angle, I'm sure, that they'll do on TV this week with Kane and Daniel Bryan. God help us all. We'll get into all that and more next week on the Sound Off. Until then, be well, stay safe, happy Mother's Day, and we'll see you right back here next week. Take care, guys.
You've been listening to the Sala Monster Sounds Off, giving you the good.
I beat the authority, and right now I stand here as the new WWE World Heavyweight Champion!
The bad.
Brock Lesnar into the cover, hugs the leg, the streak is over.
And the ugly.
Well, we are here with the new married couple.
Now we're tag team partners for life.
Sean and Marty said the same thing once upon a time.
Oh, I knew he was going to do that.
What a despicable act that was.
Oh, my God.
Well, mostly the good.
Sala Monster Sounds Off.
Since 2007 on the SalaMonster.com, Stitcher Radio, and iTunes.
Sala Monster Sound Off.